Malcolm Homeline is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. We will conduct the weekly update and get Mr. Homeline's Tisha B'Av message on the air this morning as well here at JM in the AM. Malcolm Homeline, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure, even on this Erev Tisha B'Av, to be with you.
Yeah, what a strange calendaric quirk that we are speaking on what normally would really be Erev Tisha B'Av, but it has a different type of feeling because, of course, tonight begins Shabbos. By the way, the rumor is, with the big week ahead next week and a lot of action going on, obviously one of the highlights is the tremendous Siyum HaShas at MetLife Stadium, and rumor has it that you are going to be you're going to be encouraging certain dignitaries in the overall Jewish community to be there at MetLife Stadium on Wednesday night because you feel it would be an inspiring experience even for those who may not be familiar with the Talmud.
Absolutely true, and we are bringing quite a number, and I see that there's growing interest and fascination actually on the part of many people about this whole phenomenon as they see it. They generally don't understand it, but I think that they really have come to realize that there's something very special happening. And I think it's a great event for Klal Yisrael to see the unity of the Jewish people coming together, and hopefully no one does anything to disrupt that and to maintain what could be such a Kiddush Hashem, to show the world a really wonderful side of religious Judaism.
Yeah, it should be amazing. We'll be at MetLife Stadium on Wednesday morning with JM and the AM, and I hope that, in fact, your guests and those who are there to be inspired, well, I should say I'm sure they will be. All right, it's amazing how every week there seems to be a change in the setup of the Israeli government. So as I understand it now, has the Kadima party, in fact, split up? Are some members going back to Likud and others trying to form their own faction?
They're still in negotiation, but that certainly seems to be the direction in which they're going. And I think that it is likely that a number of them, led by Tzachi Hanegvi, who is a significant player in the Kadima and was chairman of the committee, Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee, until he had to resign over a scandal. But he emerged from it fairly intact, so I think they his defection would be significant.
And that means back to Likud, right?
He would go to Likud together with 3, 4, up to 6 members, according to all of the discussions that have been going on. But there's also talk of another faction that would go to the left, maybe with Tzipi Livni, to Yachimovich, to Labor, or to Lapid, or to form a new party. It's all unclear. What seems to be clear is that people are second-guessing now Mofas's decisions, both first to join, then to leave, and question of whether he gained anything, because if they go to elections today, the general assessment is they get 6-7 seats from the 29 they had before.
Wow. What a drop that is. It's funny how everybody, when Kadima was formed, this goes back obviously close to a decade at this point, it's funny that that so many people predicted its doom, and it hung out for a while, you know what I mean? It didn't experience what so many fringe parties or new parties experience in Israel, which is usually, you know, fizzling out pretty quickly.
Well, they had a strong base and a message that was appealing, offering an alternative, and it reflects the frustration, I think, of people in Israel about the political setup, the need for electoral reform. It's something that every party endorses, but of course no party implements, because everybody has their own vested interests, which they want to protect.
Right, and Livni would officially end up where? Not with Likud, correct? Would it be her own faction or what?
Livni?
Yeah.
Livni right now is out of everything, but
right,
she would probably go with Labor, I think, more likely.
In other words, she's trying to get former Kadima colleagues to join her in a more left area of the government.
I think she would say center, but
right.
There is no other option. It's either going with Lapid or
right.
Now this Chaim Ramon has talked about starting a party, and I think that's something she would probably find more attractive.
What do you think of the Romney visit to Israel? The timing is interesting. First of all, do major candidates usually go this closely to the election? Do you remember a presidential election where the opponent of the incumbent actually traveled to Israel this close to the election?
Neither the incumbent nor the opponent, and there are a lot of people question the wisdom of a trip like this because, you know, everything you do is subject to such scrutiny, like we saw Romney's probably innocent comment in London,
right,
becoming such a football for the political pundits this week and today, and they continue, and I think it'll haunt him even later on, that they will use this to show his inexperience or whatever, and that's natural when you go abroad and you're going to be the subject of so much attention. His visit to Israel highlights, I assume, the fact that President Obama has not visited Israel in his term, in his 4 years, although he's visited other places. I think that, you know, a lot will depend on what happens during the visit, but it's unfortunate that so much of the attention of the visit already is on the fundraiser that they have planned there, which I think is also something that people can question the wisdom of doing, because you know that it's going to be as the highlight in terms of media coverage, that they'll watch everybody who comes in and everybody who goes out, and right, rather than the substantive parts, which is what I assume he would want to have covered.
So so this trip certainly, I'm not that you would advise him one way or the other, but it looks like, as an observer, you would say this trip should have been made a lot earlier than now.
But he has visited earlier. I don't fault him for that, and I think it's not an unusual thing to do. It's before Labor Day. It's not in the heat of the campaign yet. Right. It's before the conventions.
What do you think of the timing with Tisha B'Av? Could have done that a little better.
Well, I don't think in the Mormon calendar it has much significance. But
I understand. You know what I mean. Is he breaking the fast with the Prime Minister?
Yes.
He really is.
Yes, and they changed the fundraiser to a morning because originally they didn't, I guess they didn't look at the calendar. But I have to tell you that I know people here who did the same thing, because people called me about having a lunch on or meetings on often on a fast day. You know, just people checking. They were responsive immediately to change it. So
there are some people, I think, who are not traveling with him, who normally would have joined him on a trip to Israel because of the calendar. So he may be missing out on some of his Jewish advisors because of this. Now, that may be a benefit to him. I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know of anybody who isn't going or didn't go because of this schedule, but I'm sure there are some who are affected.
What do you think of Shelley Adelson being so out there when it comes to the efforts to get more Jews to check out and explore the Republican Party? There's, of course, the whole issue of trying to sway Jews from Democrats to Republicans. In his opinion, that's a good idea. But it seems to be getting too much front-page attention. What do you think?
I, for one, agree with that it's too much of a focus. I mean, if you want to do it. You see how much George Soros does,
mm-hmm.
And it only gets exposed by when the media or somebody finds out about it. His generosity is quite remarkable, and his commitment to the causes and what he believes, and to try to implement it, and is obviously opposing President Obama in a very strong and outright way, and he's putting his money where his mouth is. But I, for one, believe that it's more effective sometimes to do these kind of things quieter, because you set yourself up, and you know, you don't want it to look like somebody buys the election or impacts the election. And already there's a Democratic backlash operation where they're using this to put together a group of their high donors to counter the Adelson initiative.
Right. Again, from the observer's standpoint, one would have to suspect all this will probably make very little difference. The numbers of those of the numbers in the Jewish vote nationally will likely not change much from last time, correct?
No, I'm not sure that's correct. I think the polls show that there is a chance for a significant shift, but significant can be 15% or 20%.
Well, 15, I think, would be a real shift, yeah. When I said very little change, I was thinking 0 to 5% change.
No, I think the polls now show certainly a much bigger shift than that. And targeting the states like Ohio, Pennsylvania, Florida, where you have significant Jewish populations, they're not decisive, but they are significant, and you shift a certain percentage there, they think will make a difference in the actual outcome. I think that's something we'll have to examine in hindsight to see whether that's really true or not.
Jewish communities of Florida are going to be getting a lot of visits between now and November, huh?
A lot of visits, and they get a lot of attention, and I can say that New York will be an orphan in this.
That's
not going to get very much attention, as will much of the country. The money, you don't see ads here, you don't see it, and people think that the campaign haven't started, but if you travel to Ohio, you'll find out that, you know, every space for ads is taken, and you have all these super funds and outside funds, Republican and Democrat, also buying ads, some of them more creative, some less creative, so they're already feeling the impact.
President signed the Enhanced Security Cooperation Act with Israel this week. Is that symbolic, substantive, both? How would you describe it?
That what? I'm sorry?
The Enhanced Security Cooperation Act with Israel, signed by Obama. Is that symbolic or substantive or both? How would you describe it? Because I guess this is, it seems to the reader, at least when I saw the article about it, that it's a, that it's a, you know, an automatic, so to speak, for the American president to sign this act.
Well, it is true that this is not a new initiative, but it is significant. The act itself is very important. And today, the president is going to sign the aid package, I think, at 10 o'clock this morning. And obviously, they highlight things this year more than things that might be taken more routinely in other years.
Correct, right.
But it shouldn't obscure the significance of what the content is, and that the security cooperation between the United States and Israel. Look at the stream of people coming to Israel this week. You had James Brennan, the head of intelligence and counterterrorism, dealing with the Bulgarian incident and its aftermath, Petraeus and other the Secretary of Defense, the others coming and going. So the security cooperation, and when you look at the issues, look, you have Syria, Iran, all these things are areas where Israel plays a critical role. Unfortunately, Israel was excluded from the counterterrorism conference, and as it was from the NATO conference. I think this is inexcusable and a mistake. Israel has a lot to offer, and it you've seen the criticism by many about the fact that the United States and the Europeans went along not to offend Turkey or whatever else the reason was. It's not acceptable.
America's one and only Jewish Moments in the morning radio program, heard on listeners-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Malcolm Honlein with us. We are discussing the events of the week in the weekly update. By the way, schedule-wise, there will be no weekly update next week. We'll be live from Champions Gate, the YU Yeshiva University Leadership Conference down in Florida. 2 weeks from today, the weekly update will return with an analysis of the news. Also, check out our homepage, jmnam.org, for information about the weekly update podcast. Weekly update podcast makes it even easier for you to access our conversation each and every week. Check it out. Go to jmnam.org. You'll find that information in the news section of the homepage. Most recently proposed House sanctions against Iran, those went through or are going to go through soon?
They have not gone through yet, and we are hoping that that will happen very quickly, and that we're trying to get the both House and Senate leadership to move it. Look, every additional sanction helps. They're not decisive. We saw the reports that Ahmadinejad says they now have 11,000 centrifuges working. That's 1,000 more than the International Atomic Energy Agency saw, both at Natanz and at Qum. This includes Fordo, where we may even have a much higher number, but this is what Ahmadinejad himself says, and it would show a significant increase just in recent months. They're talking about making their Navy submarines nuclear and their oil tankers, and the reason is that that's a cover to build reactors that would be able to have a dual use. The developments over the last week in terms of Iran's involvement in terrorism, certainly in the Bulgaria attack, but also in events in other parts of the world and their support for Hezbollah's terrorism. I mean, all this continues unabated. Ambassador Shapiro, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, said that it's not clear that the Iran talks are going to continue, but low-level talks between Iran and EU officials went on this week in Istanbul, and there's another one expected in the coming days with Cathy Ashton and the European Union's foreign policy head representing the P5+1, and the Russians continuing to say they're not going to allow the full sanctions to be implemented. So Iran is essentially getting a bye right now, and as much as the sanctions are clearly biting and hurting and having an impact, it's not enough, and it has to be. There have to be other credible threats. You know, the Iranians challenge the whole Arab world, not just Israel. I saw a remarks made by one of the heads of the Iran Revolutionary Guard, where he talked about any foreign powers that intervene in Syria would get decisive blows, but he calls them the hated Arabs.
Oh, I thought those were the Syrians who were saying that they would attack with chemical weapons.
This is the Iranians, but they call them the hated Arabs, which refers to like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the Gulf countries, etc. And I think that the funniest story of the week, if anything can be funny in this, is that the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran admitted that they had a new problem with a very vicious and malicious program, malware program, which introduced a virus into their nuclear facility. And one of the things it does is that all of a sudden the computers start playing Thunderstruck by AC/DC.
Yeah, I saw that.
Some rock and roll song.
For those parents who always said it's annoying and terrible for you, I guess they proved it right.
I wish I knew what the song was. I would understand if there's some special significance to the wording.
No, I think it's just loud, that's all. I think the point was that it's just a startling tune. But I'm right as well that the Syrians also said if anybody intervenes, they're ready to attack with chemical weapons, right?
They said that the chemical weapons will never be used against internal foes or uses, but would be used if anybody tries to strike from the outside, that they would utilize them. And we know that they have huge stockpiles of sarin, nerve agent, mustard gas, and cyanide. We know that in a recent raid on a police station in Syria, in northern Syria, they found stockpiles of gas masks for the police officers, and there's reports of them moving some of the chemicals, and we don't know whether they were moved to consolidate them or they were moved to complicate the Western efforts to track them or to put them in a better position to be used. The real danger is that Hezbollah can get a hand on it, and that would be something that I think everybody fears. It's certainly all the Arab countries fear it, not just Israel. It's something Israel is watching. The United States is watching.
What's with distribution of gas masks in Israel?
It has stepped up to now, I think, 3,700 a day. It's usually around 2,200. I think the vast majority of Israelis, I don't want to venture the number because I don't remember it exactly, but I think it was in the three-quarters range have gas masks, but there was increased demand, especially in the north, from people for it because of the fear that he could do, you know, a last-ditch effort or try to unify the country by prompting something that would enable him to use it. We know that Syrian troops crossed the border in the Golan this week, but they quickly withdrew. Israel filed a protest at the UN over it. But they were in pursuit of some of the rebels and crossed the border.
Wow.
The real key, what we've seen this week, is they're fighting in Aleppo and Damascus. And as I said for the last year, that when either of them really is on the verge of falling, that's when Assad will fall. And you look at what happens if the Russians abandon them in the UN, if the economy collapses further, though it's really on the verge, and you see whole divisions and their generals moving over. So we're seeing signs of each of these things, and even taking over some of the neighborhoods in Damascus and Aleppo, but the government troops are successfully fighting back, and if they succeed in driving them out, this could delay, extend this process for a very long time.
Is there a possibility of real Turkish physical intervention in Aleppo?
I don't think so. I don't think that anybody wants to get caught in this situation, especially fighting in urban areas.
So what is Turkey doing now? What was the basis of, what is the essence of their reaction to all this?
They have extended the zone in along the border with Syria, where you have refugees pouring in still, and they have provided the opposition, which is based primarily in southern Turkey, though you have some along the border with Lebanon and Iraq and Jordan, but primarily in southern Turkey. That's the operational base, and they're giving them support. But we know also that this border of Turkey is being used by al-Qaeda units. I spoke a couple weeks ago about the evidence that the al-Nusra Front was crossing over, but now we know that there are the Azam brigades and other groups linked to al-Qaeda that have crossed over, and they announced their war against Iran and Israel. And of course, to establish a free Palestine. But the extension, the presence of these groups, one of the things that people don't understand, and this is also relevant to Turkey, is the nature of the construction of the society in Syria, which is largely tribal. You have individual tribal confederations that can have 1.5 million, 2 million, 1 million people. They cross borders, let's say, with Iraq and Syria. And these groups are really critical, and those of their leaders who stood up against Assad are considered heroes. But these groups are now organizing, and what it adds to is the likelihood that if anything should happen and there's a change, they're going to start demanding, and you're going to making demands for their role in the new government, and it's going to add to the rivalries that exist already. And it's part of the problem is that the Syrian opposition is so divided amongst itself, and you don't have the emergence of a key leader in this process.
And that's all to the benefit of Assad. He's got the best of an opposing situation.
That's right. And he, you know, he, for instance, on the chemical weapons, as you said, it serves his purpose to have people be afraid, because then they say, well, we can't go so far because he might use these things, and there's evidence that he was going to spray pesticides from planes in Rostan, in one of the areas that the Free Syrian Army operates in. And I know the Russians sent a message to him and said, don't even think about it. And of course, President Obama and others as well threatened him about it. But this is not beyond the possibility. And for Israel, for everyone else, this is a huge concern, because the chemical weapons can be carried and transferred, and they have the missiles to also deliver a payload with a chemical and biological weapon.
So to say that it's an equal worry for the Prime Minister to the Iranian situation is certainly accurate. These are two major priorities that he has to deal with right now.
Right. A different magnitudes in nature, because the size of the Iran nuclear program, I don't think Syria poses a threat to Israel's existence. They can do a lot of damage, and if he would start shooting off those missiles and do the other things that they're in a position to do in terms of we don't know the extent today of how far they're on the nuclear program, but certainly in the future, so the Iranian threat, but the truth is that the Syrian threat is based on the Iranian threat. Without Iran, Syria could not survive this period.
Right.
And so it's inextricably linked, the two of them. One of the things I think that people should listen for, and I don't know if you've heard, wherever the reporters are with the Free Syrian Army after they've had a clash and visiting, the only noise you hear in the background is people yelling Allah Akbar, which is a call of the Muslim Brotherhood and of the Islamists. And I think that that's a concern that people have, and one of the reasons why many say that, you know, you want to get rid of Assad, but you got to think about what's going to follow.
Right. Because we've seen in so many other countries what has followed.
Exactly. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood is not as popular there. It's not exactly the situation that you had in Egypt, where it was the only organized...
And a lot more factions also, right?
And many more factions.
Right. In Iran, they have to deal with the whole public image, the whole, trying to instill some confidence and in the people because of the economic situation. I mean, they're giving speeches there on a regular basis now, trying to encourage everybody to hang in there while the while this battle against the West continues. And it must be very difficult to maintain the public morale when the economic conditions continue to get worse and worse, right?
Absolutely right. And the economic conditions worsen, but they are able to survive. They find backdoor ways to bypass some of the sanctions. That's why the new sanctions, the other sanctions, are all important. But the question is the application. We just saw a report that Germany, in fact, is continuing to provide dual-use technology, meaning technology that can be used in nuclear program and other purposes and military purposes, even though they can have some sort of civilian application. So the question is not just having things on the books, regulations, restrictions, sanctions. It's a question of the implementation of those sanctions, and that too often is absent. And we see that the reading of the mood, you see the shifting of where we said to watch the terrorist groups, you know, how they move from Damascus. We see Palestinian Islamic Jihad leaders have left Syria now during the last weeks, and they moved to Tehran. And even Ramadan Shallah, who's the leader, is now supposedly working out of Iran.
Is it a good idea for American members of the president's cabinet to be visiting Egypt and continuously, it seems, meeting with the new president of Egypt?
Well, look, Egypt's a very important country to the U.S., to the region. We want stability. We want to see the government not fall back in terms of it. The commitments on the Israel peace treaty, what goes on in Sinai, what goes on in Gaza. Obviously, right now, they're not doing that much, and at least the prime minister, you still have the military in a critical role. I think the idea that we want to see them strip the military of power doesn't make much sense in this period, and Morsi is certainly seeking to try to consolidate his position. He welcomed the head of Hamas this week. This is the first official visit by a Hamas leader. Certainly Mubarak didn't do it. He did not commit to opening the border with Egypt, between Egypt and Gaza, which was expected.
Right.
He did commit to increasing the flow of fuel that comes from Qatar to Gaza. He has made some other statements, but he's trying to walk a very fine line. But we know that the Muslim Brotherhood is very flexible. They know how to put on the camouflage. They know how to create a certain front. Now, he does have realities to look at, and you see that the rejection at the polls by many people in Egypt of the Islamist approach, and after their initial stunning victory. So and there's a Pew poll that is really quite remarkable, the PEW Pew, that does an annual poll, and it shows, in terms of attitudes to the United States and Egypt, 79% are unfavorable. Egypt, it's 86, and in Turkey, it's like 72, despite all the efforts to reach out to Turkey. But when you ask them about Iran, in Egypt, the unfavorable is 76%, and in Turkey, it's 55, and Lebanon, 61. Interestingly, that Pakistan, the unfavorable for the U.S., is 80%. But when you ask them about Hamas and Hezbollah and things like that, groups like that, you find that in Egypt, it's 75% unfavorable, and almost 60% unfavorable to Hamas.
Who are the ones then that are protesting against Mahmoud Abbas? Those that are more radical, or those that are more, I don't know what we'd call it?
Well, you have Muslim Brotherhood, and you have groups that are associated with Hamas who take advantage of this, of the opportunity, you know, to, this is all internal politics between them, and there are, of course, legitimate groups that oppose it because of his of the corruption and the fact that you don't have elections. And
who has more favorable numbers, Abbas or Netanyahu?
Where?
In Israel.
In Israel?
Yeah. Because I see Netanyahu's numbers continue to go down. Another week of the arrow pointing down.
Well, you know, that's Israeli politics. It's not unusual.
Yeah, I guess. But he has no, as we discussed last week, he has no opponent. Nobody who could take his spot away from him at this point. Although you would still say a week later that we're heading toward early elections, right?
Well, there's more and more talk about having early elections, and there's some parties maybe within the coalition that would also favor elections, but I think the people really don't want them. It's an expensive and tedious process, and most people don't think that there will be any real change. So what's the point of spending all that money and going through all of this if you're not going to produce much of a change?
Malcolm, before I turn to you for the Tisha B'Av message, one other thing, and I know that Jewish leader predecessors in the role of Jewish leadership have had to deal with this situation, but we know what happened in Germany regarding circumcision. Now we read about Austria with the restrictions being placed on hospitals. And even the mayor of the city of New York made an interesting comment this week regarding one of the somewhat accepted customs regarding circumcision. Are you getting nervous about this worldwide effort as it continues to pick up steam?
I wouldn't throw them all into the same pot.
Correct.
One is a health concern.
Right.
And, of course, the others are being couched as health concerns.
Right.
But, in fact, you know, Brit Milah and Shechita, ritual slaughter, have traditionally been bellwether issues, that when anti-Semites and others want to strike at the community and to demonstrate anti-Semitism, they go after circumcision and shechita, but they do it under the guise of humane concerns. They don't care when the slaughter is of Jews,
right,
but they care about the stunning or not stunning of animals, etc. So, yes, I do take it seriously. In Austria, it's only one district that was not adopted by the country, and in Germany, you know, they're passing legislation that will obviate the impact of the
colonialism.
To take it seriously, absolutely. When you I take seriously what happened at the IOC with the International Olympic Committee, the refusal to have a minute of silence. It's not because it's the biggest issue, some people have asked me, but it is a statement that when people who were killed at the Olympic Village, participating in the Olympic Games, we're not talking about them commemorating 9/11, we're not asking them to commemorate, you know, victims of terror unrelated to the Olympics. This is directly related to the Olympics. And the fact is that a moment of silence often speaks louder than words.
Mm-hmm.
That there would have been a declaration about a united stand against terrorism, global terrorism. Every country participating has been a victim of terrorism. And this would have been an opportunity, utilizing this 40th anniversary, to make such a declaration, but they refused. And then they came up with some namby-pandy thing to do in Munich or whatever as an excuse. But you've seen the number of countries, Canada, United States, Europeans, others, who have spoken out. It's an amazing piece by Osnar about the exclusion of Israel, not only in regard to this, but also those counterterrorism conferences, and saying, how dare you exclude the country that's been most victimized by terror. But I think there's significance, and a lot of people raise the question, and I don't think it's the most significant issue. I do think, though, that it has taken on a symbolic significance, and their refusal speaks loud, and the moment of silence would speak even louder, and I hope that the First Lady and Mitt Romney, who are there, will do something demonstrative, and I want to credit Bob Costas, the sportscaster, who already 2 weeks ago or so announced that he's doing the reporting for NBC, announced that he is going to do a moment of silence during the broadcast.
Right, and we know how much that time is worth on the broadcast.
That's how much these things. I think it's a courageous act, and I hope people have written and stood by him, because there are many others who will criticize him for it, but I think it's very important to let him know that he's not alone, and we appreciate it, and to really hold the IOC, the Olympic Committee, has a long history of anti-Semitism.
Correct.
Avery Brundage, who headed American and then headed the thing, and it goes back to the International Committee. It goes back to World War II.
Sure.
And there is, unfortunately, a long history. Today we have an event. There's an event that is going to be held at 11 o'clock at the consulate to denounce this, that the Board of Rabbis, JCRC, others put together with public officials. Because I think it's important to speak out about what this means. Why is this significant?
Get there early, Malcolm. Security at the consulate takes about 30 minutes.
I think it's outside, so I don't think it's a problem.
Inside joke, folks, but a good one. All right. Tonight begins the 9th of Av. The observance, of course, is postponed because of Shabbos to tomorrow night and Sunday. Your message is?
Look, I think Tisha B'Av has such significance to us in that we should remember what it is that we mourn. We don't mourn stones. That's not what is significant. You know, the Maral, I saw, has an explanation that national unity, something we've talked about often, its importance to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to God. And as long as the Bnei Yisrael, the Jewish nation, was unified, Hashem gave us a protection. When unity was lost, the protection went with it. And we see in the time of the second bias that people were learning, that was, even though the Romans ruled, but the nation was doing well, and it managed to put up with the restrictions and survive. But it was excess animosity was enough to cause the destruction and the exile for them and for all the generations that followed. We're living at a time when decisions will be made that will also affect generations to come. And we see how easy it is for people within our community to be pitted against one another. I think the significance of the Singing Mashas, and I think if the Olympic Committee had problems, I don't know how they were good at did this, but it's an amazing feat, and Rabbi Gertzlin and all his team should be congratulated in advance. I'm sure it'll all come off well. But the point is that we shouldn't see this as divisive in one sector of community, and even within the community you see divisions. It's a time when we're facing all the issues that we've discussed. It's a time to come together. And what I think we mourn, this is my own interpretation, on Tisha B'Av is the lost opportunities. Ooh. Is the lost opportunities for all the generations that maybe we would have been rebuilt the Beis HaMikdash already. We would have been redeemed already had we come together. And we have to think of what we failed to do and how the price would be paid by our grandchildren and their grandchildren.
Excellent message. Malcolm, an easy fast to you.
And I'm going to be speaking this Shabbos at Congregation Kahal B'nai Shlomo Zalman after davening and after Kiddush at Ocean Avenue and Avenue L.
Everyone make sure to attend. No. Do they have a large seating area, or is that
not so large?
Oh, so
we want the small people.
Yeah, make sure you get there early, folks. All right, have an easy fast. We'll speak 2 weeks from today. Malcolm Holine will next join us 2 weeks from today. Next week will be at Champions Gate, the Yeshiva University Leadership Conference down in Orlando. 2 weeks from today, we'll reconvene and discuss the events. 2 weeks worth of events in this crazy world of ours with Malcolm Holine.